One of the things that I did think about, I was thinking about this morning after Pete gave that word, was that it's not inappropriate for Anna to be talking about what she's going to talk about this morning. I think that God's heart is, still, we're still exploring that and wanting to go forward with that, and then God's doing other things too. That's all part of the plan, you know. And I'm actually quite excited, really, because of what's been going on this morning and what Anna's going to be talking about. So let's just pray, and then we'll let her loose. Okay, Father, we just thank you for everything that you are to us. And we just want you to anoint Anna to be able to speak as well as she possibly can to us, so that we also might be able to hear what you're saying. And Lord, we just pray that you'd help us not to switch off at bits or just start to think about something else, but actually to have our hearts really and minds really open to what you're saying to us, and how we might actually get involved, and how our lives might change because of it. Amen. Okay.
Right. Another week, me again. So, we're talking today about unseen, which is a concept that I have been thinking about for some time. It came about in the summer, really, and I've had a burden, really. I asked Dave to talk about this, so I've only got myself to blame, really, for doing it. So what I'm feeling, really, is that it's relevant to Dayspring as a whole, really, and that we want to develop it further together. So as I explain it, hopefully you'll be stirred up a bit with it as well. I've got lots to get through, because it's one of those things that just sort of builds on you, so just bear with me, hopefully we'll get through it. So we're going to be talking about the world, really, and the first question, really, is what does the world look like? Is it a planet? Yes, but it's also a group of people. So what are they like? There's 6.8 billion people in the world, and if we represented those people here today, there's about 36 of us here, that's what I've based it on, each of us would represent about 200 million people. Now, you might have noticed some stickers on your chairs when you sat down. No one mentioned them.
Yes.
So, if you have a yellow sticker, can you stand up? Yeah, you might. Okay, so that's the yellow people. I'm not sure who stood up and who sat down. There should be about six.
Yellow.
Are we rich?
Sorry, we may have lost a bit from.
Okay. So you people here, you represent just over a billion people. And you're all the people that don't have access to any safe water. Okay, so just think about this. This could be random. You are drinking perhaps water out of it. Okay, have a sit. And the green people, can you stand up? Should know. Should be about 14 of you. Any more?
There's a green here.
Fill the gaps. If there's any gaps next to you, stand up for them as well. Right, so you're 2.5 billion people. That is a huge number, isn't it? And you are the people that don't have any decent toilet facilities. So you're just going in a field or whatever, or in the river. In the river, and then the other people are drinking it, probably. Okay, the pink people. Pink. Right, you're a billion people. And you lack any access to healthcare. So you have no doctors. You might be using the witch doctor or whatever, but you have no healthcare, no medicine. And then the blue people. You might have two blue stickers or one blue, but if you've got blue, if you stand up. Okay, you represent all the people in the world that are living on less than $2 a day. So that's about £1.50, is it? £1.75? Okay, so you're the very poor people. If the ones of you sit down, if you've got two blues, and if you've just got one, keep standing. Okay, the ones that are left, then, are the people that are living on less than £1 a day, so less than $1.25. Okay, because You can sit down if you want. Just imagine that for a second, what that would be like. You could probably barely feed yourself, let alone buy clothes or shelter. You might be living on the streets. And that was, so that's 1.4 billion people. I mean, it's really not a small number, is it? I always thought that £1 a day was better than it sounded, really, because things, you know, you think about the developing world and things are cheap over there. But that figure's been worked out as actual purchasing power. So that really is £1 a day. That is what all that you'd have.
What you mean relevant to our world?
Yeah, relative to our currency. Yeah, what you could buy with £1 a day. That's the purchasing power. Okay, so there's huge numbers of poor people, but really they're quite unseen, aren't they? They're going back to this word. They're not. They don't have a huge voice, do they? They are ignored, really. So what could we do to make things better for ourselves? So one of the answers is to live in an extended family. So if you can get more adults together, then you can share the load and pay for things together. And you've probably heard about people wanting sons rather than daughters, and that's because sons can do more work. And if you're working in a manual labour environment, then you want a son, and daughters often come with a dowry. You need to pay a dowry when they get married. So I am aware that in this country we don't often feel that rich. We're constantly told that we're rich, but perhaps one of the reasons we don't feel rich is because our culture makes us all live separately, so we're all sort of paying bills and electricity, and we're all quite in small units, aren't we? With just maybe one or two adults paying all the bills. Okay, so what's the norm in this country? Does anyone remember this programme? I took the ages finding a picture on. So this is supposedly the average family in England, well, it was 20 years ago perhaps. And this was filmed in Reading, where I grew up anyway, so it was quite funny. So I think it's meant to be less now. I think it's 1.8 children is the average now. Anyway, if we look at what the average is, this is in India, what their TV programme would be. So this is 4.6 people living in a single-room dwelling. And that's the average for them. So there's obviously people who are a lot worse than that and people that are a lot better. So, you know, we do have things quite good in this country, although often, like I say, we don't feel rich, do we? So I had a think about what it would be like if I lived with my extended family, which wasn't a nice... if we go on to the next... this is what we'd be like. So I did work this out on the most extreme example, picked my richest relative. So this is me and my mum. I've worked this out on a matriarchal sort of thing where the daughters would live with the mum and the mum would live with my gran in the middle, live with my mum. So there'd be 8 adults, 5 children. Our income would be over 2,000, 200,000 a year, and our house would be about 1.43 million. And I know this is an extreme example because we've got 3 generations here of home ownership. So, but I mean, we'd all probably be pretty similar. We'd all be pretty well off if we lived in that extended family. Okay. So what else could we do to make things better for ourselves if we were that poor? And these ones you've maybe heard of before. Stop sending our children to school so they could work. Stop buying medicine. And turn to crime, obviously. Then, okay, we'll go on to the next two as well. These are perhaps more shocking, but they do happen, and not in small numbers. So you could stop feeding your daughters. As I said earlier, daughters just aren't worth as much as men, really. Can't bring in the income. Could you imagine how desperate you'd be to stop feeding your daughters and just the men and the boys had the food? And then, of course, there's selling your children to human trafficking. So poverty is the main cause of human trafficking. Let me get this book. The problem now is that because of the media and television, people in poor countries do know how rich we all are. In the past, they didn't know. So they have an enormous sort of incentive. They're desperate to get to the West, as it were. So in a minute, there are 2 children trafficked for sexual exploitation, and that's 1.2 million children a year. And sometimes they're stolen, and sometimes the parents go along with it because they're desperate and they don't have the money to feed their children. So Steve Chalk and Sherry Blair have written this book, which I would say needs an 18 certificate or something like that, 15 certificate at least, because of what it goes into. But actually the children they're talking about are 11, 12. I've got one photo which I didn't manage to scan in because it was quite a small book. I just wanted you to pass it round. And these, we'll pass it round, so these children look like a primary school class, but they're all girls that have been rescued from sexual exploitation. And they're just so young. So, I'll pass it on. And it's just, it's awful, isn't it, really, that all of this goes on, even when we're, you know, we're blind to it, really. Okay. So if we go on to the next slide. So as you think about this, I start to ask, well, why are people poor? And the way I was brought up, well, I wasn't brought up thinking this, but I think at the back of my mind, I always thought, well, they must be doing something wrong, poor people, or they must be lazy. And if they're not lazy, then perhaps their leaders are lazy, or somebody's doing something wrong. But there is a warning on this verse, really. This is not saying that all poor people are lazy. It's just saying that lazy people can be poor. Yeah? And there's far more complicated reasons, really, why people are poor. This is Kanchi, who's one of the women that I help with, Women Without Roofs. She's a widow, she has three teenage sons, and she works as a labourer. She works at least 8 hours a day as a labourer on a construction site. And there's just no way you could describe her as lazy. I got a letter on Friday from my trustee who's out in Nepal at the moment. And I was having an eye on whether to read it to you, but I will do. I will read it to you because it really upset me. And it seemed like it was important timing given that I'm talking about this today. I had to ring Carol and get her to pray with me. So this is from Rini, the trustee. Had a good day last Friday, visited 7 more ladies, mostly okay except for Kanchi. Anna, the rooms were up 2 flights of rickety stairs and it was pitch black. The room was unbelievably wretched. We asked her to look for a better room and we should pay the rent. Currently we're paying for the room that she's always lived in. 3 boys and mum, so sad. My horse lived in better conditions. I was ashamed and embarrassed and will not be able to tell the Robinsons, that's the family that sponsor Kanchi, how bad it is. We need to buy her a cooking stove. She is using 3 ancient rings and paraffin. The walls are black. In addition, the roof is tin, so condensation drips into the room. Rini sent me about 8 letters, and I mean, that was the worst of them, but I was upset on Friday having read all of that. That these women have to go just through such terrible things. And like I say, she's not lazy, she's just a victim, really. So if I go on to the next one. So why are people poor? Geography plays a large part in it. Natural disasters, unfertile land, your climate, or you might be landlocked. Trade happens almost entirely through ports around the world, really. If your country doesn't have a good port, then you can be hugely poor just because of that. So Bolivia, Nepal, Mongolia are all countries that are landlocked and they suffer because of it. And even within large countries like China, it's the coastal regions that are rich and the inland regions that are poor. Rulers make decisions on behalf of the population. Just as we've experienced in the last year, the banks being bought up, and perhaps we didn't decide on that. It's just happened on our behalf. The rulers in countries will make decisions, and they're just not necessarily honest, really. The king of Swaziland is the 15th richest man in the world, yet his people are dying of poverty, and the life expectancy there is only 40. He's richer than our queen, but he's just not doing anything for his people. And it tells us in the Bible, doesn't it, to pray for our rulers, and I think in this country we're not quite used to doing that. I think they're much better in the C of E, really, that are praying for their rulers, but you know, perhaps if we don't pray for ours, but also pray for other rulers. Pandemics like HIV and AIDS wipe out huge numbers of the population, and particularly in Africa, the problem with malaria is huge. 10% of graduates from their universities die before the age of 30 because of malaria or HIV. And so they're losing all those trained people, and it's just costly, basically, to the government to keep training people and then lose them. Brain drain is another one. That's the loss of people that are educated because they go to other countries. Nepal is like that. Everybody in Nepal under the age of 30 wants to leave, really. They're all looking for jobs, registering with agencies, and no one really wants to be there. The Gurkhas are obviously staying in this country now, which is good for them, but actually it's not great for the country because the money's now not going back into Nepal. The Gurkhas would retire basically as millionaires, and all that money was going back to Nepal, but now they're staying in this country. So it's good for them, but it is hard for the country. Religion and culture, again, plays a part. If you think about the country of India, it's not like Africa. It's not a huge desert. It has mountains, it has rivers, it has fertile land and access to ports, yet it remains hugely poor. And a lot of this is to do with Hinduism. If a river floods over there, we would take the view of building a dam, but they just pray to it and give it some sacrifices, and obviously nothing gets better. And the caste system, again, you do the job that your father and grandfather did. So if you're a cobbler or something, you know that you're going to be a cobbler from birth, and it doesn't really give you much incentive to then better yourself, does it? In India as well, 1/5 of the grain harvest is lost each year because it's eaten by rats, and rats are viewed as holy, so they're not curbed or killed. They're just allowed to carry on and eat 1/5 of the grain. And then women is the last one. If you don't educate your women, then they don't look after their children so well. So then their children don't get educated and get immunisations and get medicine so much. So if you can educate the women at home, then that plays a huge part in improving the economy. And also, if women then get jobs, you've got double the workforce. And obviously, some people are affected by all of these. I mentioned Nepal and India and a few of them. So there's all these factors making things bad. Okay. Let me have a quick drink. Not used to talking. Can't get a word in at home with my two children. So I've just left this blank because really what I've said so far, actually we kind of know, don't we? It shouldn't be that new to us, really. We get it in the news all the time and see things like comic relief, and it isn't something that should... Well, I mean, it is shocking, but it shouldn't be that much of a shock. We're all sort of educated and can read the news and whatever. So why is it that in the Western world in general we don't do more for these people? Is it, I'm going back to this word now, is it because they're unseen? Is there something that's kind of blocking our vision? So let me read this verse to you that's coming out. Is that a bit small? This is the smallest font I've got. So it says, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of power, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist." So in particular I wanted to highlight verse 3. So it says, "He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide by what he hears with his ears." So it's saying that things that are unseen, that are hidden perhaps, he'll be able to judge and take action without that. Do you see? Does that make sense? So I just wanted to share a bit how my eyes were opened and how I feel that I noticed the unseen. Obviously there's lots of probably groups I don't notice, but obviously the women in Nepal are important to me. So in parts it has been gradual. I don't know who was there on the encounter evening with Carl Wills. He said something to me that was key about the age of 11. At the ages I couldn't work out what this was because I became a Christian before that and I spoke in tongues before that. So I was thinking, what happened at 11? What was significant about 11? And at 11 I got my first pen friend in India, and I suppose that's when it first started that I had a real person-to-person connection with a person in the third world. And I visited her when I was 20. And then in part So in part it's been gradual, and then in part it's been revelation. So at Dayspring one Sunday, we were encouraged to pray for God to give us more love for people. And I did pray this, but I never told God which people. I mean, I kind of just thought the whole world. So it was a bit of a surprise, really. But, oh, here's a charity for you, Ron. And I... And I told you last week that I met Eileen in the pool and she needed help with the women that she was already supporting. But just prior to that, I think it was when my eyes were really open. So I was at a prayer meeting at the church with her there, and God gave me a vision, and this vision was of people that were living without the fruits of the Spirit. So, go on to the next one. So it's people living without all of these things: love, joy, peace, gentleness. And they weren't, not only did they not have these things, but people weren't showing them to them. So, you know, if they're not being shown self-control, then perhaps they were being abused or being hit because other people didn't have self-control. So I can't remember now whether it was a vision of women in the pool that had these things or whether it was just people in the pool having these things, but it was very much that they were living in this kind of blackness where these things had just been robbed from them. And obviously Eileen was at this prayer meeting, and she's a kind of scary missionary type woman. So she was probably there praying for me to get this vision. But obviously some good has come from this. Although at first it was really hard to have this sort of picture of people living such sort of miserable lives was really depressing. And there was one junction in Nepal where the sort of main ring road met the main road coming in. And it used to just be full of people. And I remember always going through this crossing thinking, oh, there's just so many poor people, they're so desperate, and I'm just feeling really low with it. And I prayed to God, obviously, about this, and it took ages, probably a bit slow or something, but his response really was that he had put lots of Christians on this planet and he hoped we were going to do something about it. You know, he had got lots of Christians and he was hoping to work through them, and we were his hands and his feet, as it were. So we're called to be like Christ. So going back to this village, obviously this is about Christ. So he's calling us to be like this, to not judge what we see with our eyes and not to decide by what we hear with our ears. And that, so we should be giving justice out. Okay, to see the unseen. And of course the unseen are unseen to us. God sees them. So what do we need to do? So this is our kind of mission statement, that we want to encourage and equip each other to seek out and pay attention to the unseen, to pray for and to act for them. And we're hoping, obviously, that you'll all be involved too and want to have this heart for the unseen. And we are doing this already. Coming up, obviously, with Open Blue and the bus, where Dayspring's already working with the unseen people. And I spoke to, well, emailed Andy this week, and particularly in Thingley Park, where he's working with the travellers, he feels that they have almost chosen and drawn back from society to make themselves unseen. And with Ruth in Romania, she took an active decision that she would take into her home the children that were least likely to be adopted and fostered. So, you know, again, the unseen and the neglected. And we want to extend our reach. You know, there's no reason why all of us can't have this vision and be taking action, really. But dealing with the unseen does have its own challenges, really, because it can often mean that they're unreachable. You know, particularly for us living here, we can't reach everywhere. So where do we start? So really, like me, I think, we need to ask God to give us a passion. If we don't have a passion from him, then we quickly run out of steam, and we don't keep motivated if we don't get that passion. Okay, do you want to show the next bit? So I've just listed some ideas there. But it is a dangerous thing to allow God to show you what his heart is like, because his heart is so much bigger than ours. And it can be quite painful. I've already said it was quite depressing once I'd seen that vision, before I then sort of worked through and got the answer. And it can manifest itself physically. So well, like on Friday, I just cried when I had that message from there. And I mean, I often cry really when I get emails from Rini. When I read the book, A Thousand Splendid Suns, has anyone read that? It's written by the same guy that wrote The Kite Runner. I was depressed for the whole weekend, I think, after reading that. And sometimes, I know men don't particularly like to cry, it can also feel like you're being punched in the stomach. So you just feel, oh, this is terrible, I can't put up with this. And I have felt physically sick as well. I watched something about the child soldiers in Liberia recently, and that kept me up at night because I just felt so sick. And it is this sort of stirring in your spirit, isn't it? When you're sort of getting a glimpse of what God sees, it can really get to you. So I will... We're running out of time already. There will be a chance at the end. I'm going to pray for you.
You're fine.
If that's okay. And ask for you to have more love for people. Okay? So it could be for any one of these specific groups. These are just some ideas. I've got a handout at the end. You can have some of these. And who knows what will come of it. Maybe you'll end up in some country. Okay. We haven't got time for discussion. Moving on. So what can you do to be more Christ-like? And I've split this into two, and I'm not sure that this is theologically correct. I did talk about this with Dave Halls. He wasn't too sure. But I'd use these titles. They help me. So there's Christ as a Lamb, which is all about sacrifice, and I've written their time and money. And Christ as a Lion, which is about getting angry and seeking justice, really, for these unseen people. And I think we're used to hearing about giving, obviously. But time is also important. I mean, time can just be about learning about these people in the first place, making time to watch that documentary on TV, or getting that book out of the library, or whatever it needs. And obviously praying as well takes time. So I'm just going to look briefly at these four bits at the bottom, the blue ones. So obviously giving is a, I don't know if it's contentious, I don't know, but it's hard, isn't it, to know how much to give him, to give to people. And there's a book by Peter Singer called The Life You Can Save, and I'm just going to, it really talks about the ethics of giving. I'm just going to read out an example from him. By the way, I do know that Christians give lots more than non-Christians, so I'm not nagging you or anything. I know from the charity it's far easier to get money from Christians. But just think about this. Okay, so on your way to work, you pass a small pond. On hot days, children sometimes play in the pond, which is only about knee-deep. The weather's cool today, though, and the hour is early, so you're surprised to see a child splashing about in the pond. As you get closer, you see that it's a very young child, just a toddler, who's flailing about, unable to stand upright or walk out of the pond. You look for the parents or babysitter, but there is no one else around. The child is unable to keep his head above the water for more than a few seconds at a time. If you don't wade in and pull him out, he seems likely to drown. Wading in is easy and safe, but you will ruin the new shoes you bought only a few days ago and get your suit wet and muddy. By the time you hand the child over to someone responsible for him and change your clothes, you'll be late for work. What should you do? So that it seems, well, I'm guessing that you're going to say you're going to go in and save this child. And it seems perfectly reasonable, doesn't it, to go in and get your suit wet. But there are 27,000 children every day that die from easily preventable causes, such as malaria and diarrhea. And they are just as easy to save as that child drowning in the pond. So why is it that we don't, you know, why is it that we're not saving them, as it were? It seems such an obvious thing to do, and we all agree that it's right. And so I would assume also here that everybody has drunk something this week that isn't tap water. And if you did that, that means you've got disposable income. You know, it sounds strange, but you have. If you drank something other than tap water, you know, you're choosing to spend money on something that you don't actually need. So giving is a hard issue, isn't it? My family, I feel, has been quite blessed with giving, and my grandparents give to tons of charities, and they're really good because they tell me about it. And I think that's important as well, that you tell your children. If you're tithing to the church, make sure your children know, because that's telling them that, you know, it's possible to live a normal life and give money away. I think people are so scared of departing with their money, aren't they? And feel that they need it all, everything that they earn. And my grandparents supported a charity in Nepal, and they've recommended that to me. So that's been, you know, really good that we're carrying that on, really. So just encourage you there, just to review, you know, what you're giving, and can you give more? I told Simon when we got married that I wanted to give 40% of our income away. He doesn't remember this, but I remember this. And we're not there yet. But, you know, we're trying to get there. Probably when the children have left home, maybe we'll get there. I don't know. But, you know, don't just leave it at 10% to church. I don't mean, that sounds harsh, but, you know, do just think about what you can give away and whether you can make it more. Next was buying. And here I feel that we're directly related to unseen people, because they're making the food that we eat, the clothes that we wear. And obviously we all know about fair trade, but, you know, we are directly related to those people, because they've made these clothes or whatever. And we don't know who they are, do we? And there's a huge amount of trust that we need to give the companies that make things for us and arrange these things, that they're treating their workers properly. And it is always hard to buy fair trade, isn't it? We can buy fair trade slabs of chocolate, but if you want to get fair trade chocolate cake, it's quite hard. So, but I would encourage you just to make one decision at a time, really, and to do what you can to buy ethically. I've got a blog on this because I was interested to find out on the high street who were the best producers of food, makers of clothes, because obviously fair trade clothes is quite limited and it's quite expensive. So I just got a quick slide about who's the best and who's the worst that I managed to find out. So M&S is particularly good. They've got a carbon neutral factory in Sri Lanka, and they're making huge efforts to look after all their workers. They haven't got a co-op, I think, in Carn or Chippen, have you? But the co-op supermarket is so outspoken. I get their magazine, and they're into Burma and tar sands, and they've got all these campaigns. So again, they're really good. And if you're looking at this and thinking, oh, I can't possibly give up Primark or Matalan, they're too good, I would encourage you just to write to them and say that you're concerned about their workers. You know, before you shop for them again, almost just say to yourself, I'm not going to shop for them until I've at least written to them. And every purchase really is a vote. I mean, if you feel that you're fed up with the politicians in this country and you can't make any changes, then just if you view every purchase that you're making as a vote for that company, you're putting money into that company, then you can start to make a difference. Next one was writing. So this is really finding, giving a voice to the unheard and unseen. You can write to the companies that I've already said that are making things for us, or governments, anyone really that's having an international presence, and you can ask them how they're looking after people and say that you're interested and that you care. I have been writing to my MP quite a lot, and this is my pile here of letters and things. That's all House of Commons letters. And my new, because we've just moved house, my new MP doesn't send letters back with the nice thing on. He just sends emails back. So that's not so good, is it? So I like him. And these are my letters to like clothing companies at the back, finding out things.
To what
from
company?
Clothing companies. Clothing. Fashion. It's just a case of putting pressure on them, I think, to say that I'm interested. I'm one of your customers. Can you tell me that you're looking after people, the people that work for you well? And you have the chance now to take part as well if you'd like to, because I've got some cards from Tier Fund. Tier Fund do a huge amount of campaigning. And you too can send one to your MP. You might get a nice letter back. So look, can I hand these around? And these are just a case of filling them in. If you need the name of your MP, but you can find that out on the internet. And they're just sending them back. And Tier Fund, I have to say, when I was younger, I thought Tier Fund were really sort of old-fashioned, but they're really with it now and really into campaigning and run really good online. Their website's fantastic if you want to look at that. And, of course, you can write your own letter. If you write just one letter to a company and actually write it yourself with your own words, then it's worth the views of 2,000 people. That's what the company will take it as. So it's hugely effective if you want to make your voice heard. And the next slide is you can demonstrate. Donna's not here, is it? But Donna and I are going to this next week, and Zach. We're dressing up in blue and going to the Wave. And this is all about climate change and how it's related to poor people, really. Tier Funds is, again, very active on this. We're going to a Tier Fund service in London before this. And the poor are being hugely affected by climate change, and it's really asking our government to take account of them, really, and to look after them as they're preparing for the talks at Copenhagen, which you've probably heard about on the news. They're on the 12th, I think, they start. So people like us obviously bear huge responsibility because we've created all this sort of carbon that's in the atmosphere, and now, particularly in Bangladesh, they're suffering, and other Pacific islands. And this is where my interest sort of crosses over with Simon, because he's looking at future conflicts, and Bangladesh is a huge sort of future conflict area. As people are moved out of the, as the waters rise, people will have to move out of Bangladesh, and they're Muslims, and they will move into India, which is Hindu, and there'll be a clash of peoples as they do that. So it's really looking again at these unseen people groups. We don't hear about that all the time, but it's thinking forward and saying that we want our government to take actions and to help the Bangladeshis, etc., and to cut our own carbon emissions. Okay, last slide. So almost a little bit over. So if we're going to make a difference to unseen people groups, then it needs to start with us and us getting a passion for it. And we need to allow God to open our eyes. We sang Shine Jesus Shine this morning, which I thought was really good, because I think as he shines, then people come out of the shadows, don't they? There's people that have been hiding there that perhaps we haven't seen. There's a light shone on them, and we can see them, and that means we can take action and help them and do the things that they need. So we're all, I hope that you agree with me, that we are all guilty of ignoring the poor, and whether it's intentionally when we're perhaps not giving much, or you know, we're not acting, or if it's just in the case of our carbon footprint being too high, we're sort of part of this whole corporate can't think of the word, we're all involved in it together, aren't we? This whole, it's so hard to take actions on our own, but and our government's obviously responsible for a lot of the actions that we are taken. Does that make sense? No. So if it's okay, I did want to just run through a prayer, and it is actually going to be saying sorry for those people, that saying sorry to God that we have taken part in this. And obviously I'm including myself in this, that you know that there is obviously more that I could do and I'm not doing, and I do want to do more. And then it just moves on to asking God to give us a love for the people that need us, these unseen people. So is that okay that we pray? Okay. Father God, we are sorry for oppressing the poor and not noticing the unseen. We ask you to forgive us for those things that we have done and for those things that we have not, that would have made a positive change for others. We're sorry too for those decisions and actions that are carried out on behalf of us by our government and the companies we buy from. We ask you to open our eyes so that we can see unseen people. We ask you to reveal specific groups to each of us that you want us to care for. Give us more love for them and a passion to make their lives better through action and prayer. We want you to prompt us when we need to do something, and then give us the ability to act as you would act. Thank you that you have chosen us to be your representatives in this world. Amen. Thank you. I've got handout again.
Okay, whilst you do that, two things. One is this thing about unseen doesn't stop here. It's just a talk, I think, that Anna's giving, and then that's nice, we'll have a little think about it, and it's going to go away. But really, it's going to be, it's the start of the debate and discussion in Dayspring over the next months and stuff, as we try to work out what God's saying to us about these unseen people groups. And of course, as you've heard, you know, we are actually already parts of Dayspring, if you like, or bits of Dayspring are already sort of getting into the unseen people groups that are more within our reach straight away. So the other thing is that the second